Welcome to Franchise Festival, where we go in-depth with noteworthy video game series from the last 40 years. For Season 5, we're working through BioWare's Mass Effect. Be sure to let us know what you think by emailing franchisefestival@gmail.com or reaching out through our website at patreon.com/franchisefestival. And before we go any further, listeners, I wanted to just give a quick note here. This is only the second re-recorded episode in the 6-year history of Franchise Festival. We originally recorded this about a month ago, and it got devoured by our technology. There were weird glitches and so forth on the recording. It would have been a profoundly unpleasant listening experience. So we are now back here to re-record it. And this time, originally we had all three of your favorite hosts in the business, but today it's just the two of us. This is what our schedules allowed. So without further ado, we're your hosts, Chris.
And I'm Hamilton.
And today we'll be discussing the second act of Mass Effect 3, from our introduction to a new, very old teammate through Cerberus's assault on the Citadel.
So we're going to enter Eden Prime. This is not a sexual mission, but a very interesting one. My understanding too is that it was actually DLC.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if you get the Legendary Edition, it's just all packaged in, so it doesn't come across as DLC. So, for you as a first-time player, it was just de rigueur, but yeah, in the original game, you had to buy this separately, though it was available at launch. They couldn't get this mission and character ready for the on-disc build, so it was sold as DLC.
Which is, I guess, both sad and understandable. Like, I'm glad they
Exactly.
included it. I think it should have been honestly like free DLC because like this is a very important character. But I guess, take what you can get.
This is very EA in the early 2010s, right? This was like the company voted worst in America, which obviously is farcical. When we have nightmare or like warmongers and stuff, but it was it wasn't doing good business in the early 2010s. Very nickel and
Very,
dimey.
very Final Fantasy 15, where it's just like, oh, you want the whole
Yeah.
story? Well, buy these 17,
Yeah.
DLCs that are actually the entire game.
Buy the game 5 times plus a movie and a book. Yeah.
So, this DLC mission, or if you have the Legendary Edition, brings us to Eden Prime to investigate a Prothean relic that's being dug up by Cerberus. So, Cerberus, once again, is up to no good in the neighborhood. So, this mission, and we might have covered this before, like I said. A lot of these missions that aren't essential are kind of like run and gun type things.
Pretty generic.
Generic, but the scenery is interesting. You find out that this mysterious relic is not relic at all, actually, but a Prothean who has been in stasis.
Yep, the precursor race is finally available to us. This is very cool.
And we covered this the old recording, but his voice is amazing.
Yes.
I forgot what the Keith David. Like some people just have a voice you can make love to if it hears a shout
Yeah, Keith David's one
out.
of the best in the business. I am remiss. I did not get the voice actor for Javik, the Prothean. I should look that up. Maybe I'll include it in the notes.
Yeah, which is a fantastic job.
Yeah.
To get to this Prothean and unlock the his stasis pod, we have to do a bunch of kind of like you have to search nearby, kind of generic Mass Effect gameplay, but we need to cover our allies who are trying to unlock the pod for it to safely open.
Right.
Now, it is kind of interesting because along the way, we get some flashbacks of what the Prothean's final hours were.
Yeah.
At this time, we don't have his name. It just says, like, Prothean. At least I
Yeah.
think it is. I think it just says
It's like
Prothean.
commander, maybe, or general.
Or Commander.
And it's conveyed by those beacons, like kind of like how we found on Eden Prime way back in Mass Effect 1. And that's part of why it's it's poetic and neat that they take us back to Eden Prime for this DLC for Mass Effect 3, because this is where our story began way back in the first game. But we get these little beacons that transmit this Prothean's memories to us in that way that only Protheans can do.
And through that, we do find out that, as Chris said, he's a commander. He oversaw. This was back in the day where the Reapers were attacking, and there really wasn't a good way to stop them. So it was just kind of failure after failure, genocide after genocide. And this Prothean commander was trying to safeguard the several hundred Prothean battalions, cryostasis pods that we see in ME1.
Yeah, these are just like the ones that we encountered over on Ilos way back when.
However, as we know, there were no survivors. In fact, he kind of just saw his entire world just kind of go ablaze. He was literally the only survivor of his entire race, which is pretty tragic.
It's really brutal, and they sell it really well. Like, he comes across as a very stoic individual. He's like a higher up military figure. But because we get, I think the flashbacks do a lot of work here, because we get to see each like small catastrophic failure in cascading sequence in the past, where like, oh no, the Reapers are on this planet. Okay, we can still get to safety. Oh no, indoctrinated Protheans are attacking. We can still close the gates. Oh no, they're inside the preservation facility. All is lost. And so, he's expecting to wake up, whatever it is, I'm blanking on it, 20,000, 50,000 years in the future with an army to rebuild the Prothean species. And instead, he wakes up alone.
Now, interestingly enough, when we get him out, we find out that his name is Javik,
Yeah.
and he is quite dramatically different from what we would think of, and certainly what Liara would think of him, or his race in general.
Right.
He is classified very early on, in my opinion, very accurately, as a space racist, which he kind of is.
He's the Ashley of the Protheans, if you will.
Quite so.
Every species has one.
His racism is almost even more degenerate in a sense because like he just thinks everyone's below him.
Right.
I guess we actually do understand that people far removed from us, ancient people, were actually not super civilized or whatever. But he was to a point where he just believed, he and his race believed that they were so above every other creature
Yeah.
that they're almost pitiable to amusing. I think he said like Liara was like, no. He said that Salarians were like tadpoles or like fish people back in
Exactly.
the day. We were apes.
Yeah.
And a lot of his dialogue is just basically just saying how amusing it is to see us try and do things.
Yeah, we survived. All of the species that exist in modern council space survived because we were so low as to escape the Protheans' notice almost. Like we were animals to them. The
Or
funny thing
cattle.
is, yeah, exactly. The Protheans, there's a lot of cool historical tie-ins with the Mass Effect series, and the Protheans are very much an image of like ancient Imperial Rome, where you'd have a society that you could either buy into when conquered or be destroyed. Those were your two options. It's one of the interesting parts of Prothean society that there were functionally no spacefaring races besides Protheans, because any that existed were wiped out to reduce competition.
Or assimilated, I guess that's the curse of
Yeah.
being the apex.
Yeah, for a series that has, I mean, as anything with a lot of people working on it, have, some kind of problematic story elements, especially in the first and second game. One of the interesting things that we see through Javik is that the cultural homogeneity of the Protheans was the key to their downfall. They were easily destroyed by the Reapers because they were so centralized and lacked a diversity of people and ideas. And so, one of the chief advantages that the modern council space has, as Javik comes to realize over the course of his game, this is kind of his arc, is that diversity is a strength for council space. The wide variety of ideas and people and value systems and so forth prevent them from being as easily predated upon by the Reapers. I really like that.
And like I said, like it sounds bad because it is a bad mindset, but in the grand scheme of things, for the writing, I think it's actually pretty phenomenal because
Oh,
that is
brilliant.
like they
Yeah.
weren't the advanced race that we would think they were, especially with all the technology that they created. It's understandable that like us following them centuries, even longer after, we're like, oh, they must be like these super understanding beings. They must have like been
Mm-hmm.
unified. They are so mentally beyond us. And then we find out that they're actually almost more primitive in certain ways than we are.
Yeah, at the risk of getting on a soapbox, this is it's very similar to me to how folks romanticize the past
Yeah.
just through a lack of familiarity with it. So, you have this is the most microscopic version of this. This doesn't really matter, but it feeds into broader human trends, which is the inclination to say, like, arts and entertainment were better in the past. Like, the music of the 70s was great. The music of the 60s was great. It's so much better than what we have now. And if a person who says that kind of thing goes back and actually listens to what the top 40 hits from the year they're describing are, they will be sorely disappointed. Like, the past is just the present, but before. You can't really make good value judgments about the past and present because we're functionally always the same. Like our ideas evolve, but we don't change that much.
Nostalgia is like one of the most potent toxins in American society and
Yeah,
human
you are preaching to
society.
the choir, man. I agree wholeheartedly. Nostalgia is deeply dangerous.
Like it's euphoric because we all have it,
Oh, yeah.
but it's so toxic because it paints things in a very unrealistic perspective that if you just take 2 seconds, or heck, go ahead and take yourself even 5 seconds and realize that, like, oh, there's some stuff that actually really sucked.
Yeah, it blinds you to ways that you can improve in the future to think that the past was gold. But you only think that the past was gold because you're ignoring large portions of it.
And you were a child, or presumably you were younger.
Right.
So the world is bright and interesting, and you're constantly absorbing things, and you probably have been less jaded by how the
Exactly.
world actually is. And then as you get older, you get more realistic, and things are just like, oh, okay. Going back to our Prothean friend here,
Yes.
there is one thing about them. Again, there are certain things about them that actually are pretty advanced. For example, written language. He found that pretty silly. And that's an important part because we'll see that when he gets onto our ship, he actually learns a history about our ship and actually the people that are on it through physical touch.
Yeah, so cool.
They communicate through visions, ideas, or emotions, which is why they have the beacons in the first place, which is why when, for example, when Shepard touched it, like all those memories poured back into him. That's how they communicated.
Right.
So it is a very interesting point. Like we were saying before, like I'm glad that they included it. Do they have to charge more money? No. Is it good to kind of know the history of the Protheans and like to see this writing come to be? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Javik's story is my favorite character story in Mass Effect 3. Like the way that he punctures romanticism about the Protheans to Liara, but also the way that he grows and comes to understand the ways. There were ways that his society excelled, and he looks down on modern society because we don't, I say we, Shepard and crew don't do the same things. But also over time, he comes to realize the advantages that his society was missing out on. It's a really, I don't know, it's Mass Effect at the height of its powers, kind of playing with archetypes, but doing unique things with them.
It's very apropos to our lives. It's
Right.
we understand the world because we've existed in it. It's been colored by our culture, our rituals, our habits.
Yeah.
Whether they thought they were super advanced or not, at the core of it all, Javik believes what he believes because that's just how he was raised.
Yeah.
So throughout the course, as we get to know him and he learns us and he sees that, oh, maybe my entire race didn't have to collapse into nothingness if we just work together. Like he has also one of the better character development of a lot of
Yeah.
characters that we see, honestly, in other games as well.
Right.
So definitely the height of writing. I very much enjoy it.
Yeah, it's done very sympathetically. Like a character like Javik could easily be like a whipping post. He could be like he there
Just
are
endlessly
several
racist.
yeah, there are several pitfalls that they avoid here narratively where like he could be a super advanced space creature like Liara once, and that would be sort of boring for other reasons. He could just be a dirtbag jerk the whole time and not learn anything. Which would be disappointing, but instead we get a full fleshed out arc with him.
Definitely one of the better characters. So he was on my team quite a bit just to kind of hear
Same.
his perspectives and also see his improvement.
Exactly. Next up, we have a side quest in the Attican Traverse, where we get to reunite with a beloved character from Mass Effect 2. We travel here to this obscure rocky planet to find the Krogan scouts that Rex told us about back in our previous episode. And when we find them, they have set up a small base camp and are led by Grunt,
Woo!
the perfect Krogan, as created by Dr. So-and-so back in Mass Effect 2.
My favorite dead friend.
Exactly. Yeah, Hamilton did not get to meet up with Grunt here.
I met a plus one random Krogan number 285.
Exactly. So we talked to Grunt here, or Random Krogan 285, and they're investigating Rachni sightings, which should not exist because the Rachni theoretically either are dead if you killed the Rachni Queen in Mass Effect 1 or fled the galaxy. If you save the Rachni Queen in Mass Effect 1.
That would be me.
Yeah, so we travel down into the caves here, and a cave-in separates us from Grunt's team as we move through these spooky tunnels. There's a lot of aliens kind of energy. There's a lot of these very webbed eggs throughout the cave system. Pretty gross. And we get some flamethrowers to set them on fire. And so, as we get down into here, Grunt's team and our team simultaneously get attacked by these mutated Rachni. They look real horrible. They're like the Rachni are already big Starship Troopers kind of bug monsters, but now they're bug monsters with like weird cybernetic veins running through them and like arms in wrong places and stuff. They're grosser than ever, if you will.
Like the flood, kind of.
Yeah, they're very flood, yeah, from Halo. So the two types of Rachni that we get introduced to here are Ravagers and Swarmers. Ravagers are those gross Reaper modified Rachni that I just talked about, and they can spit acid and leave a damaging acid blob on the ground after death. So it kind of hems you in from moving around the environment while you fight their allies. And then swarmers are these little guys who pop out of the egg pods and just kamikaze towards you. They come running towards you and explode. So they're high priority targets. After the fight here, we reunite with Grunt by disabling a big Reaper-made barrier, which causes our teammates to remark the Reapers are here. And we head down further into the cave and find the imprisoned Rachni Queen if she survived Mass Effect 1. If you didn't save the Rachni Queen in Mass Effect 1, or if, like poor Spencer, your save file got corrupted and you had to start Mass Effect 3 with the comic book version.
Oh yeah, because he had to do the whole comic book. Oh, poor
Yep.
guy.
If you did that, you get a weird clone Rachni Queen who is, I don't know, tries to pretend to be the Rachni Queen, but is secretly evil. Spoiler alert, the real Rachni Queen is cool. She was trying to honor our deal and stay off the grid, but the Reapers attacked and corrupted her brood of little Rachni. And so we have the option to either free her or kill her following a big fight with waves of Rachni. After that, after we make the decision to free her or kill her, we reunite with Grunt as we escape to the ship, and he holds off a bunch of Rachni heroically, allowing us to escape. And then there's all kinds of ways that this can play out. And I've played through this game a couple of times, so I can speak to a few of them. And thankfully, Spencer had the bad save file, so he clued us in to a few of them as well. If the Rachni Queen died in Mass Effect 1 and is replaced by a clone, if you save her, she will eventually turn on you later. You get the benefits of her joining you for what's it called? Like galactic readiness?
Yeah, the galactic readiness for the Reapers.
Yeah, so you get the benefit of that up front when she joins you if you spare her, but then later on she turns on you and removes not only her portion of the galactic readiness, but also a bunch of Krogan who she kills.
Yep, that's so messed up.
Saving the clone Rachni Queen is a bad call. If you save the real Rachni Queen, she does help you, but it does set up Grunt here for this dangerous situation. My understanding is if you don't save her, Grunt also doesn't have to save you from a bunch of Rachni. So you're kind of trading a dead Rachni Queen for a live Grunt.
Well, or trading a live Rachni Queen for a dead grunt, in my case.
Exactly,
I had nothing to
exactly.
lose.
Yeah, you were living on the edge, baby. You were a rebel who played by his own rules, man. If all has gone according to plan, best case scenario, you save the Rachni Queen in Mass Effect 1, you saved Grunt in Mass Effect 2, Hamilton, and you did his
I
loyalty.
tried. I did his
It's like
loyalty
how Mai
mission.
Kasumi died. It's like how Mai Kasumi died off screen.
Yeah.
If you do his loyalty mission as well in Mass Effect 2, and saved him at the end, he survives his heroic sacrifice and becomes a war asset for Ansel. So you can kind of double your gains here, both getting the Rachni Queen on your side and getting Grunt on your side, along with his squad, if you fulfilled all of those conditions.
Like, I think for me, because I didn't have Grunt, so I mean, there was a name for him.
Yeah.
Instead of Grunt, you get like a captain that like Rex personally vouches for. The problem is, it's like in mine, because I did the whole Rachni Queen in ME1 and freed her, let her live,
Right.
I got her. However, the captain died. So I didn't get like his support, but I still got some Krogan.
I don't think there's any way for the like the nameless Krogan, not literally nameless, but nameless to us. He doesn't matter in any cosmic sense. The fake Grunt, I don't think there's any way for him to survive if you spare the Rachni Queen here.
Yeah, no, he just went away.
And who cares? Easy come, easy go.
So the next mission we have is T'Chanka. So T'Chanka is the home world of the Krogans. But yes, there are two very big missions, and they are necessary to complete, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I imagine that the plot can articulate differently if you don't do a portion of these, because the bomb mission is given to us at the same time as the Krogan mission in the Attican Traverse, where we reunite with Grunt. And so I wonder if both of those are optional. I wonder if only the genophage cure portion of this is obligatory. I have no idea. I did both of them in full disclosure.
Yeah, and I did so as well. Especially since the bomb mission could have the potential of blowing up the entire planet.
It does have a surprising outcome if you don't do it. Yeah, it occurs to me. Yeah, I looked it up. Yeah, you can not do this, but the outcome is hilarious and disastrous.
Yeah. So I imagine, I hope that most people would consider at least doing it, if not just to like build up your resistance against the Reapers, if anything else.
Right.
But this is actually given to us by Primarch Victus.
Yeah, the Turian leader.
Yeah, the Turian leader. And he told us kind of a little. He didn't tell us about this, but he did say that he had a secret to tell us, but he couldn't say it in front of Rex.
Exactly.
Who's the Krogan? Would it be Grunt if Rex wasn't alive? Because if a
No, it's
Krogan
some
is
schmuck. I can't remember who it is. I read about it. It's just some idiot.
okay. But yeah, there is a Krogan like emissary that's going to be on your ship, and Victus is on your ship as well at one point, and he says like, "Oh, I have a secret to tell you, but I can't say it in front of the Krogan."
Right.
And for good reason, because it's a freaking bomb.
Yeah.
So, he asks us to disarm it. And I believe his son is on the planet who's also trying to disarm it.
I don't have his name in the notes because, for all the world, I was taking these notes after I played rather than while I was playing because it's Well, we're not professionals, and it's a lot of work to write notes while you're playing games. It makes them very irritating. And so, I wrote down my recollections after the fact, which I think captures the highlights. But every once in a while, it does erode some of the nuance. And the nuance here was Lieutenant Victus's name. So Primarch Victus is now the leader of the Turians. Lieutenant Victus is his son, who is running this Turian special forces team on Tuchanka with the goal of disabling this planet killer bomb. The kicker that we get in the background that Lieutenant Victus gives us is that the reason why Primarch Victus was so cagey with us and didn't want to say this in front of Rex is that this planet killer bomb was planted by the Turians at the end of the Krogan War as a failsafe in order to destroy Tuchanka, their home planet, if the Krogans ever found a way to get around the Genophage. So it's a real horrifying war crime committed by the Turians that Primarch Victus is hoping that they can just kind of coast by.
Just sweep under the rug.
Yeah, just, we all did some crazy things during the Krogan
It's
Rebellion.
just a little oopsie daisy.
And so the problem, however, is that Cerberus discovered this bomb and is now attempting to activate it to take the Krogans out of the equation for resisting the Reapers. So the Turians are trying to make good on resolving this problem of their own making.
It's one of those complicated things where it's just like, this is an unforgivable war crime because they're, well, I guess there aren't children, but there are women, whatever, it's life.
Right.
Life should be, not coveted, respected,
Yeah.
whatever the case may be. But on the other end, if I have to play devil's advocate here, the Krogans were like a murderous psychopathic race, who are super highly dangerous.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I
So
get
I
why
guess
they
it's
did it. That every Turian knew somebody who had been killed by the Krogans. I get the why they did it, and also why it's embarrassing now. Like
and
it
why
all
it's,
makes sense.
but in either case, like Chris said, they are trying to disarm it because it's just like, okay, well, the Krogans, maybe they have potential.
Yeah,
I mean, they
less
also have
murderous.
been less murderous and also kind of genophaged at the time. We haven't quite undone it yet, or maybe you can. I don't know if there's an order, like if you can do the bomb and then the genophage, but whatever the case,
Yeah, that's a good
they're
point.
trying to rectify a wrong.
I think you have to do this one first. Don't quote me on that, but I think you have to do this first.
Which would make sense, because I feel like if we cure the genophage, could they just do like a take backsies? They're like, oh, yeah, we can blow up the planet after all, so they can have kids. They're now a threat again.
Right.
No, we're Shepard. We're not going to let that happen. Of course we don't. So we're going to go down to that planet. And we're going to rendezvous with Lieutenant Victus's son, or Primarch Victus's son, Lieutenant Victus's son, Lieutenant
It's
Victus.
Victus's all the way down, Victi.
I got none of that sentence correct at all.
We got Victi on the brain.
Victi.
Yeah.
He's just the son. I'm going to call him
Yeah, the sun. The
that.
sun.
The son. So as we make it through the mission, we eventually do save Lieutenant Victus and his men from the assault from the Reaper forces. We're also going to fight off Cerberus because they're the ones who are trying to detonate the bomb in the first place because they just turn into massive dickholes.
It's all they got. One of the things that I wanted to draw attention to here is that the main enemy during this period where we're saving Lieutenant Victus, the son,
The sun.
is a flying harvester. We have to fight a few of these harvesters, which we first encountered way back in the Mass Effect 2 Tuchanka mission, where we're helping Grunt carry out his bar mitzvah or what have you, become a Krogan man. And in that mission, they just drop dudes into an arena where we were fighting a help me out here, Hamilton. What are those big worm things called? Oh, fiddlesticks. They're in the notes somewhere.
Good grief. Okay, it's here somewhere. They have to be.
Thresher Maw.
Thresher moss,
Thresher
yes.
Maw. Yeah, so we were fighting a Thresher Maw with Grunt way back in Mass Effect 2. And these harvesters would drop dudes in to fight us, but now we actually get to fight the harvesters themselves. And they have this powerful beam attack. So they'll usually be stationed at the end of a long kind of hallway that you have to run down with little diverticula off to the side. And so you have to approach them until the beam is about to go off and then duck into the side to get away from it and then get up closer and closer and closer and then wreck them.
Yeah, they'll eat through your armor, so you got to be careful.
Yeah, you're so right about that. Yeah, these are a nice diversion from the standard Mass Effect battles. I thought the Harvesters threw an interesting wrench into things.
I kind of wish they added like more interesting enemies instead of just like more bullet spongy enemies.
Just dudes. Just a whole bunch of dudes. Waves of dudes. Sometimes the dudes are bugs, but they're always dudes.
They're always dudes. Sometimes they're floods. They're flood dudes.
Sometimes they're floods.
Floods. Sometimes they're
Floods.
floods. Floods.
Yeah, that's how they get you.
That's how they get you. Come in, they flood away. So after we get through the flying harvesters, we then have to protect Victus because he is going to try to disarm the bomb itself. So this is where Cerberus starts really swarming us. You're going to go into a lot of these battles. It's just a wave battle.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for these. Like I it's one of those things where I know that they're just kind of Mass Effect 3 battle.txt or whatever. But a wave battle where you're trying to protect somebody and like you have to cover all the entrances and stuff with your squad and like the tension gets higher and higher. If it's reasonably well executed, that works really well on me. And this was one of the instances where it worked really well on me. Like the Cerberus guys kept almost getting by. Like my team and I just managed to hold them off from getting to Victus.
It's the wave thing I do get is kind of nice too, because you actually get to take full advantage of tactics where you get to like order your units to like go to different places and cover it.
Yes.
Where I really found no use for that when it came to like the hallways and the linear gameplay.
Right. Yeah. It's just shoot as much as you can.
Just shoot as much as you can. So it is kind of nice to actually use the tactics that they programmed into the game.
Right.
However, it doesn't end particularly well for poor Sun.
No, that's true.
Because in the end, like a sun, he supernovas and he sacrifices himself to manually to pry off the detonator.
Yeah, it's brutal. The controls are like not working right. It's stuck, and so he has to manually climb up onto it and release it, at which point it well, you know, it's kind of funny. It blows him up. I mean, not
It's
haha
kind
funny.
of
It blows
funny.
him up. It doesn't blow the planet up.
I'm sorry, Chris. I just had this mental image of him like trying to manly pry it off and ends up just blowing up the whole planet by mistake, along with the main characters with
Oops.
it.
Whoopsie doodle. There goes the galaxy. Yeah. Doing the Reaper's work
Oopsie.
for him.
Whatever that sound is.
We gotta get Carly in here. She does a mean air horn.
Yeah, there we go.
So, fun fact on this, fun fact that I have to draw attention to, and we referenced this earlier. If you receive this on your little galaxy radar for missions and then do three other quests, you will return to find that the bomb has gone off,
Oh no.
destroying Tuchanka and removing all of your Krogan War assets.
That I did not know. Oh my gosh.
Just wildly tragic. I was really surprised to hear that the game could go that badly.
In any case, if you're successful, like me and Chris, you will save the planet, at least from the bomb. There is another part to this that I'll get to in a moment. But when we return to the Normandy, we got bad news. We have to bring the bad news, rather. About Victus's son to his dad, which, I mean, they're all warriors. I know it must be tough, but he does take it as just like, well, you know, my son was a great warrior. He sacrificed himself for the greater good.
He's a hero.
And actually, thanks to this sacrifice, it actually restores some trust between the Krogans and the Taurians. Because the Krogans are actually, they're not super happy. They do eventually find out that, oh, you planted a bomb. But on the other hand, they're just like, well, you did try to undo it. And I guess we were kind of dickholes. It's like fine. So it does kind of help mend some broken relationships.
So next up, we're still on Tuchanka, but this time we're there to cure the genophage, that problem that's bedeviled us for three games and the Krogan for centuries. So on board the Normandy, Morden finishes synthesizing his genophage cure, and he proposes distributing it to the Krogan via the Shroud, which is this colossal tower on Tuchanka. I have in the notes here originally designed to spread the genophage. I seem to recall that Spencer had some different take on that back when we recorded this the first time. So, there, listeners, take me with a grain of salt on that. My recollection is that the Shroud was built to spread the genophage, but maybe it had a different purpose. The point is that it is a facility that can be used to spread particulates throughout the jet stream and atmosphere of Tuchanka. Now, just before we can embark on that mission, the Salarian Dalitras, basically their Primarch, their leader, secretly contacts us and tells us that the Shroud has been sabotaged by the Salarians to prevent a cure. So all we need to do is make sure that nobody on our mission finds that out. If we put the cure in, it just gets sabotaged. People think that it worked, but it didn't. And then we wash our hands of the whole endeavor, and the Krogan continue being genophaged.
None the wiser.
So that's pretty sinister.
Jaltras has very strong dislike for the Krogan.
Yeah, exactly. Who'd have thought? The funny thing, too, is that the Salarians are the shortest lived of all species. So, like, she's got to be hearing about bad Krogans from, like, 16 generations back, right? She's got no direct experience, I would assume.
I don't know, because they are the ones who like created the genophage in the first place. So I don't know if they just had, this is lore that we don't understand. Maybe they just had the
True.
worst of it when they were doing their terrible deeds. I don't know.
That's true. Yeah, maybe they were almost wiped out during the Krogan Wars, and we know that if the Krogan are resurgent, the Salarians would be first on their chopping block.
Probably.
So we have the option to tell this to our allies or hide this from our allies. It's very funny. The first opportunity that we have to tell or hide this from our allies is on the shuttle on the way to Tuchanka, and I chose to tell them.
Yes.
I suspect you did the same, Hamilton. And if you go to do that, you get interrupted by a radio transmission. So you kind of get a second chance to do it later. And I assume the game is doing that to make you, like, if your knee-jerk reaction was to do one thing, to give you just a little bit more time to ruminate on it.
Like if you want to renegade it.
But it in practice, it's pretty funny. So we hit the ground in the shuttle. We secure air support from the Turian fleet and have Rex, Eve, who listeners will remember as the female Krogan who we rescued back in our previous episode, and Morden with us on the planetary surface, along with whatever team we're bringing along, our action fight squad. And when we land, we find that the Shroud is guarded by a Reaper. So we get escorted by a team of Krogan warriors provided by Rex, and we're on kind of like a convoy Mad Max road trip to the Shroud while the Turians fly overhead. Unfortunately, the mission hits some hiccups. The Reaper sees us at quite a distance and fires its big beam at us, which obliterates the highway that we're driving on and runs off the air support. So now we're kind of we're separated from most of the Krogan escort detail, and we're down in some catacombs. And we're going to try to make the best of this bad situation. The Turian Air Force still flies in to fight the Reaper to keep it occupied, while we make our way on foot through these catacombs to the Shroud. The coolest part here is that after the basic cave part of the catacombs, we come upon the ruins of an old Krogan palace complex, which reflects the Krogans in an era where they're not basically monsters. This is the Krogans back when they had more of an advanced society. This was the Krogans that developed spacefaring technology. This was a really a much more advanced Krogan society, and it gives us something to shoot for, right? Like, it's easy to sell the Krogan short based on what we've seen of them, that they're always ready to get into a fight. But they had something once. They could have that again. It could be beautiful.
I think they even said that too, like in the previous games, or they kind of remarked about like there's not any Krogan scientists anymore, to quote. Like, it seems like they are also familiar with the fact they did have like advanced technology and things, but as I guess things devolved or their situation changed, it just became a bit more like warmongering.
Yeah, it's easy to be deterministic about the Krogan just based on how their society went in the past and where they are in the present, but that doesn't mean they can't be something better.
Right.
So I really like this. It's a quiet sequence, you know, it's more implied. The cooler part here, well, I say cooler, the more flashy part here is that we see like hieroglyphs of a super thresher maw called Kalaros. This is the king of all thresher maws, or the queen of all thresher maws. It's like this mega worm thing that you certainly don't ever want to get close to. I did think that it was neat. I had to draw this in from the art book, but the palace complex architecture here was inspired by Frank Lloyd Wright, a really rad 20th century modernist architect. So I like that. We move on here and get to the Reaper, where we get this confrontation. We have to activate several Thresher Maw attractor devices, which are kind of a callback to Mass Effect 2, that grunt loyalty mission in Mass Effect 2. And once we do so, Kalaros itself appears and attacks the Reaper. It's so cool. This is like a top 10 moment from all of the games. This Thresher Maw just takes the Reaper apart. The Reaper doesn't have a chance.
It also moves significantly faster than the Reaper can. It just completely
Exactly.
outpaces it.
Yeah, stay out of Tuchanka, you jerks. Then we head inside the shroud, and this is another sequence that can articulate a few different ways. The correct way, in my opinion, is that we support Morden curing the Genophage. And if we do that, Morden takes an elevator up to the control room. And because the building is so damaged by the fight between Kalaros and the Reaper, it's falling apart. So Morden has to sacrifice himself in only a short period of time to fix the Shroud's distribution system and ensure that the Genophage cure is successful. And if he does so, we see the cure go out, dispersed out in the atmosphere, and know that things are looking up for the Krogan, which is very sweet. If we don't support the cure, we can get a variety of kind of cruel or bad developments here. We can allow the Salarian sabotage to go unreported, which means that everybody does the same things, but only we know that the Genophage cure isn't going to do anything because the tower has been sabotaged. So everybody gives themselves a nice pat on the back, but nothing changes, which is pretty brutal.
Yeah, that's dark.
Or, in the worst possible outcome, we can shoot Morden to prevent him from stopping the Genophage, which is just horrible. Like I have watched the clip on YouTube because I could never manage to do it myself. Like, Morden's the best character in these games.
Exactly. Like, why would you do that?
Can you imagine? Yeah, like, you know, cool to have all of the different ways that it can articulate, but I don't have the stomach for it.
Nah.
So if the Genophage is cured, as both of us did, Rex and Eve leave the Normandy to rally the Krogans to your cause and deliver some very sweet messages on your private terminal later in the game about how the Krogans finally know hope. So let's talk Citadel, Hamilton. You want to take this?
Yeah. So bring us back to the Citadel. This is actually kind of an intense situation. So Cerberus has taken over the Citadel. We don't quite know how deep it is yet. We get a call from the Salarian counselor, who just tells us to like come to the Citadel ASAP, like now. He does believe that there's a conspiracy afoot, but doesn't quite know the extent.
Yeah, he's suspicious of Counselor Udina, the human counselor.
Which, I mean, fair. I kind of wish he was aboard the freaking delegates in the first game so I could let him die with everybody else, but whatever. So C-Zack's pretty silent when we try to talk, which is unusual because generally every time we try to go back to the Citadel, they usually ask like, "Where do you want to dock?" So Joker manually has to take us in, which I mean, he's Joker, he's got this. However, as we leave the ship, we find a shootout between C-Zack and Cerberus all over the dock, and this is just kind of the start. I mean, Cerberus has kind of wiped the floor with a lot of the Citadel in different sections, and there are a lot of casualties.
Yeah, this was very much an inside job.
Oh yeah, Bailey is wounded but does survive. Thankfully, I don't know.
I like Bailey. I, you know, different honorable folks may disagree. Bailey is the most Canadian man in space, and I've got his back, you know?
He's fine. Space Canadian Bailey tells us that Cerberus is attempting a coup on the Citadel via sleeper agents. And we have to save the counselors, my favorite mission. I love saving them. As I said before, there's a lot of dead civilians, a lot of dead security officers. But we go to the Solarian counselor's office, but it is surrounded by Cerberus goons. Uh-oh. Another fight, which we win. We kill them all. And then the Solarian counselor appears. He was using a cloaking device. So he was in the room. He was just hiding for his life, which, I mean, fair.
Yeah, he was there the whole time.
Alas, however, one of the more interesting characters in the Mass Effect universe shows his face here for the first time, a hidden assassin that drops from the ceiling and moves into attack. His name is Kai Lang. He is a high-ranking, cybernetically enhanced former soldier. He is very, I would say, like Cyborg Ninja from Metal Gear.
Yeah, he's got big, what's that guy? Gray Fox. He's got big Gray Fox energy.
He channels that Gray Fox energy. Not quite as well as Gray Fox, but he tries.
He's like a more hateful Gray Fox. Like Gray Fox has eyes on the prize. Kai Lang seems a little bit bloodthirsty to me.
He's like an off-white fox.
Off-white fox. Eggshell fox.
yeah, you know. But he is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And he works directly for the Elusive Man, pretty much following his words to the letter.
Right.
He's prevented from killing the counselor by Thane, who, very cool, suddenly appears and duels the assassin. Not very cool, however. He's pretty badly wounded. I mean, to the point where he is on his deathbed, but he does manage to force Kai Lang to flee.
Yeah, and before we move on from here, I just wanted to draw attention to the weird ways that this can play out differently depending on previous game choices. If Thane did not survive Mass Effect 2, then Major Kirahi of the assault on Vermeier in Mass Effect 1, the Salarian general who gives the speech about holding the line on Vermeier, he's the one who saves the counselor here. However, because he can die too. If neither Thane nor Kirahi survive their respective games, the counselor is killed. So this cutscene can go some really wildly different ways. The end of it, of course, is that we pursue Lung on Kai Lang on foot, or rather in a shuttle, but the ways that it can change are really interesting.
We do have a very cool shuttle sequence, like Chris was saying. Eventually, our ship crashes because Kai Lang actually stabs its engine, which, again, this whole cutscene is actually pretty cool to watch. Gotta admit.
Yeah, it's straight out of Star Wars or something.
However, this does mean that we have to go on foot from here. And as we are pursuing Kai Lang, we actually run into a new enemy called the Phantom. They are cybernetic ninja-like warriors who work for Cerberus, probably enhanced, cybernetically enhanced. They can kind of like fade in and out. Sometimes they turn invisible, like they'll just show up in front of you and just start slicing you.
And they hit like a train. They're really hard.
So I think for me, I mean, I have the engineer thing. So my best strat was just to like, I just pummeled them with a bunch of drones. They auto lock on them, so I didn't have to really hunt them down.
That makes sense.
I don't really know like how other classes would kind of deal with them. They're pretty annoying.
I used a lot of explosives to expose them, and then as soon as they were exposed, I would just concentrate on one and destroy it. Because they don't have very high HP, so if you focus on them, you can take them out. But you need to be really quick.
Like they're cool. Like I said, like there are some cool enemies that they add in, so they're not just the run and gun bullet sponge random enemy, you know, number 87.
Right.
Anywho, Once we push past the phantoms, we get the elevator sequence, which is one of my favorite sequences of all time because it's just Benny Hill music silly.
It's very silly.
So we're taking an elevator to try to beat Lang up to the counselor building.
Yeah.
Because he's trying to kill them all off. We're trying to stop him. But we slow down his elevator.
And he's got just miles and miles of goons on top of elevators.
Right, who come and
This is so close to a beat 'em up game from the 80s.
trying to think of like not Streets of Rage, but it's just like they're just constantly coming, piling into your elevator. You kill them, and then you shoot his elevator to stop his elevator, and then it'll like plummet for like a short time. And then after like a scripted amount of time, it'll just start rising again really quickly.
It's like Kai Lenning hacked the elevator to fix it.
To like go super fast. I can just imagine him just like pulling out like a hammer and just like hitting the elevator to make it work.
This is the most Gunstar Heroes sequence of Mass Effect that exists.
I mean, it's great.
It's incredible.
Why is the elevator just like fire up at like 180 miles per hour?
Everybody on that elevator has been mushed into paste on the floor
Besides Kyle
just
Lang.
by the G-force of it. Yeah, it's very silly. Yeah, at the end of this, we managed to break into an elevator that houses the remaining council members. We like jump over onto one of the other elevators. And the Turian, Asari, and human council members, human being Udina, of course, are in there with Ashley Williams, our favorite space racist, who has disregarded her formerly racist ways
Kind of.
and is now serving as, yeah, kind of, as a rad guard to the council. So that brings us into confrontation with her.
So this is kind of the Ashley redemption arc. We are, so she's trying to protect the counselors. She doesn't really know what we're up to. And based on how we've treated her or talked to her, can change things dramatically. So if we didn't like visit her, if we're a bit antagonistic towards her, she's gonna be like, should I shoot Shepard? Maybe I should shoot him. I can't like have him get a hold of Udina. Udina? Udina, uh-oh.
Udina.
Udina. But if we have been nice to her or did visit her, she's more likely to trust us and be like, wait, maybe he does have a point. And she'll actually point the gun at Udina.
Yeah, and this goes down in kind of an interesting way. We first encounter them on the elevator, but as it gets to the top, we escort the council and Ashley outside and lock the door behind us. So Kai Lang and his goons presumably are on the other side of that door, and we're outside the door with the council and Ashley.
At least for my playthrough, I think Chris actually worked the same way as well. We went her over despite her being like, is he trustworthy or not? It is through that that we also do find out that Udina is indeed verifiably a traitor.
He's working for Cerberus.
And there's talks as to whether he was indoctrinated or whether that was him all along.
Impossible to say now.
I'll be honest, I kind of think that he probably was playing both sides. He's always been a massive dick.
He's an opportunist. Yeah.
Yeah, he'll play on the winning side. But thankfully, Ashley does come up as the hero because once Udina finds out that he's been caught, he'll try to kidnap and shoot the Asari counselor, which will give us the option of shooting him or give Ashley a chance to be the hero and then she will shoot him.
Yeah, there's a million different ways that this can articulate. Ashley can die if you aren't on good terms with her. And if you refuse to shoot anybody, your teammates will shoot Ashley if she's not on good terms with you. And Ashley will shoot Udina if you don't.
Now, I didn't realize there are so many different ways to go about it, at least for me, because I did work on my relationship with her, and she did decide to trust me, and I did not take the run. Because if you shoot Udina, that's a renegade point, which I don't really get, because again, Udina had it coming, but whatever.
Yeah, what were you gonna do? Send him through the court of law while the Reapers invade? Like, come on. It's
Right.
frontier justice here, man.
I mean, it's freaking Cerberus has already taken over the entire place. Who am I going to turn Udina into? But whatever the case, thankfully, Ashley made the decision for me and introduced him to a nice fat bullet, and he died. But yeah, he was an opportunist. He had what was coming. He tried to orchestrate this coup attempt, but unfortunately, we don't know a lot more details besides that. At the very least, we are getting Cerberus off of the Citadel. Thankfully, due to all this as well, the council finally decided to understand that, oh, maybe we have a point. Maybe Shepard actually is good for this war effort after all, and the Reapers are actually a genuine threat, especially since Cerberus may or may not be indoctrinated or working for them. So they decide to throw their weight behind us and give us their support, which is the first time in three games that I've really seen that happen.
Thank goodness. And that's that for our third episode on Mass Effect 3. We hope you've enjoyed the show and encourage you to let us know what you think by emailing us at franchisefestival@gmail.com or contacting us through our website at patreon.com/franchisefestival. Next time, we'll be moving into Act 3 of Mass Effect 3, focusing on the Quarians, the Geth, and an Ardot Yakshi monastery. Once again, we've been your hosts, Chris.
And I'm Hamilton.
Thanks for listening, folks. Goodbye.